following is an Auburn Network production.
You are on the line, live on ESPN 106.7, ESPNAU.com, and the Radio Alabama app. To be on the line, call 334-321-1390 or text 334-784-1067. Bringing you the insight and passion surrounding Auburn athletics, the SEC, and more. This is what sports talk radio should be. Lock it in right here on Auburn Opelika's sports leader, ESPN 106.7. Now, live from Auburn, Alabama, with the guys who tell it like it is and hold nothing back. You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin.
You're on the line here on ESPN 106.7 Auburn Opelika Sports Leader. Happy Monday. My headphones came out. Couldn't hear the intro music, but happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well as we get you started here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line, the show that tells you like it is and holds nothing back. And man, we plan on doing that here once again today. A big thank you to my buddy Jack Hudden, who was able to join us on the show yesterday. And man, we got a new buddy of mine, good buddy of the show, great buddy of mine. And his name is Lance Daw, the host of Locked On Kentucky and writer for The Barn as well, man. Before we dive into everything today, happy Tuesday, man. I don't know if you have talked a whole lot about it, but I don't know who turned on the AC outside. But man, it feels like you're thankful for it now, but you're going to pay for it here in just a couple of weeks.
I'm getting this in while I still can, right? With the walking around outside in this like 79, 81 degree weather. I think it really starts to ramp up tomorrow, so get it in while you can, man.
It was supposed to like rain all week, and now it just feels like it's just going to be hot. Okay, there's a little bit of a chance of rain, but yeah, back up to the mid-80s. I was talking about it yesterday with my buddy Jack, and we were watching Sunday Night Baseball the other day, and man, it was the Mets and the Giants, and it was a 6 o'clock game, so it was, what, 4 o'clock in San Fran?
Mm-hmm.
And they had beanies and hoodies on, and it's not fair.
It was like mid-low 70s, wasn't it?
At one point there, it was like, no, it's like, it was a high of like 54.
Oh my gosh.
Bro. And it's like, you compare that to the low of 71 here with crazy, crazy humidity, but we will happily take what we have right now. Yeah. We just really hope that the high school season coming up here, and inside Jordan-Hare Stadium, everybody doesn't very, very quickly regret and wish for these days right here.
Melt away.
It very much is. Man, that homecoming game is going to be absolutely brutal. But again, we have a fantastic show on tap for you today. We're going to continue some of the Auburn fall camp storylines. Again, some of the biggest takeaways from week one. Also going to dive into the offensive line group and how good do they have to be for overall success? How good could they be? Could they be top 10? Could they be top 5 in the SEC? Could they be a top 3 team in the conference? Also, Auburn and Baylor, the betting lines, man, they continue to change. It started as Auburn as a 1.5 favorite. It then did a full 3-point flip, and Baylor was a 1.5-point favorite. And now, depending on what sports book you look, you have absolutely no idea. Half of them have it as a toss-up, a pick'em game. Half of them still have Baylor as a point. Half of them now have gone back to Auburn -1. And so we're going to talk about the reasons of that. We're going to talk about the numbers that we love coming up, all before we get to Lindsey Crosby. And not a full baseball power hour, but a little bit of one with Lindsey Crosby, the Locked On Braves postcast, also with the Barn and Braves today as well. Man, we're going to talk to him about the Braves-Reds game in Bristol, the Speedway Classic that ended up being a two-day affair with the rain that turned it in from a night game into an afternoon game. And man, just whatever the Braves are saying that they're trying to do right now, what do they have left to play for? We're going to talk all about that here in hour number one. But Lance, you feel like I'm going to throw the floor to you for just a little bit, man. We talked about it on Saturday. We got to sit and watch the fall practice together inside Jordan-Hare Stadium. What are some of the biggest storylines that you've noticed as we've made our way into week two of fall practice.
So for me personally, I wasn't here for spring, so I didn't get a chance to see Arnold or Knight or just how anything was working. First thing I've seen of this team was last Wednesday whenever they opened up practice, right? Whenever fall camp got underway. This offense, as far as mechanics, flow, polish, it is, I wouldn't say light years ahead of what we've seen over the last maybe half decade, because I've only gotten to see, you know, the Harsin and Freeze years here watching practice. But this,
I mean, those are tough comparisons.
It's pretty tough. But from the wide receiver unit, as far as route running, consistently making plays on the ball, when it comes to, you know, accurate balls from the quarterbacks, everything just looks better. It looks like an actual offense is going to be ran in Auburn, Alabama this fall. That's my biggest takeaway. It's like, oh, everything just looks like an actual offense. Yeah. It looks like we're actually going to get something out of this wide receiver core in this passing game, and I'm really excited about that.
If the average fan told you that, or if you asked the average fan, look, do you think we have an actual offense this year? It sounds like a slap in the face, and I guess it partially is just from the lack of success that department has had over the past couple of years. But man, when you really dive into it, you realize that there's so much more than just that statement of, man, it looks like there's going to be a true offense that is run. We talked a whole lot about the receiving core last year and how Perry Thompson ran the fastest, had the fastest sprint speed on the entire team, how Malcolm Simmons and Eric Singleton had almost 20 miles an hour and did it with like a 20% intensity percentage, just showing how easy that speed is. And then, yeah, with Jackson Arnold, you just feel like everything is beginning to flow. And that started in the spring. It worked its way into Atlanta with SEC Media Days, again with Connor Liu and Jackson Arnold on the offensive side of the football. Keldrick Falk held it down on the defensive side of the football, but it felt like it was uniform. There was uniformity on the confidence side of things. And in the presser after the Saturday practice, they asked Jackson Arnold, you know, what are you continuing to work on in fall camp? And it was talking about the timing and the intermediate routes, right? You know, he has the go balls and he has the receivers to be able to do that, also with the quick game, but you feel like what we saw on Saturday was a decent amount of the 8 to 14 yard routes right at the first down marker. It was Cam Coleman running 8-yard curls. It was Malcolm Simmons running slants, and they were beating these defenders, and that's where you feel like you have a whole lot of confidence.
I think that the depth of Auburn's receiver room kind of speaks to their ability to play into the intermediate game. When you think about some of these high-profile guys here across the board, Perry Thompson, Cam Coleman, Eric Singleton Jr. to an extent, despite him lining up in the slot at various points.
Yeah.
Like, you think of the go ball, you think of the explosive downfield plays, but man, Simmons, Singleton, guys like Sam Turner who are impressing early. I mean, you can really work the middle of the field, and that's something that my entire life watching Auburn football, they've not really been able to do as consistently as some of these high-profile offenses have. And now that we have the weapons to do so, and you're getting to see it in practice, slant after slant during the Saturday practice. You're getting to see it more here yesterday. Auburn's throwing the ball to the middle of the field, and they're making plays and being effective doing so. That's exciting. Again, I'm just so fired up about the fact that we may actually score points consistently this year. And the weird thing about this, like last season, is like I didn't realize this until just a few days ago. Auburn was 9th nationally in yards per play, and they went 5-7. If you can find a way to not just have the explosive plays against bad teams, but also have those intermediate chunk plays against teams like Baylor to open the season, against teams like Georgia, Missouri, Arkansas, Kentucky, etc., against freaking Vanderbilt, who you only scored 7 points against a season ago.
That's good, right?
We ran it by our stats and info department, and they did not have kind things to say, but we should see a complete offense, something that I've not seen in my lifetime from Auburn. Which, by the way, to some people may say, well, what about some of the Gus Malzahn years? It's gimmicky in the way that Auburn wanted to run the system. It might have been effective for a few years, But it's not like your Ohio States, your Alabamas, even Ole Miss at very, it's not that high profile, high octane across the board offense. And I think we're going to see that this year.
Give us your thoughts. 334-321-1390. Again, without Jacob Goins, who is out for today, yesterday, and today. He'll be back with us tomorrow, but excited to have him back with no text box. But the phone lines are open for a little bit longer until we get to Lindsey Crosby at 2:30. If you have any thoughts on the conversation we're having or anything else, is there a receiver or a position group in general that you are most excited about? Give us a call, 334-321-1390. That connects you to the phone line to us. You can be on the show. You can be on the line. Again, 334-321-1390. And you're bringing up some really good points about the previous offenses at Auburn that have had success, right? Yeah. It doesn't come in three layers, right? It doesn't come with the short game, the intermediate game, and the deep ball. It was very much, we're going to run our screens, we're going to run the RPO, which is very, very quick, and then it's going to be the home run hitters, right? Yep. It's going to be those over-the-top 50, 60-yard chunk plays, but it's not going to be something that you hear a lot of in college football, and it's pushing the ball downfield, right? Yep. Just the ability to pick up 12, to pick up 14, to pick up 18 on three consecutive pass plays that weren't screens. Be able to work the middle of the field. If you don't have that middle linebacker, man, being able to use your eyes and throw a slant for 8 yards that picks up a first down, or be able to run that underneath crossing routes right in between the middle linebacker and those safeties where you can find your holes, man, you just feel like there's no way that this offense can't have that ability unless the offensive line does not show up. And you feel like that has been a very, very big question as of right now. That being said, you feel like that question mark is working its way in the right direction.
I would agree. You know, Auburn went out this offseason, as they did a season ago, trying to find players in the transfer portal that could help, you know, fill some gaps there across the offensive line. And this year, obviously, with the additions of Mason Murphy and Xavier Chaplin at tackle, you expect on paper for Auburn's offensive line to take that step forward. Of course, we
have a word on here, and it's should.
Should. Oh, yes. We've talked about this before.
I remember. That is the word that I've said, and we've kind of claimed that of, man, the offensive line,
it should be pretty good.
And
it's because of, like, on paper, Xavier Chaplin is a very good addition from Virginia Tech. Mason Murphy is a good addition from USC. Like, these, like, after being in the ACC and the Big Ten and being productive in those spots, Auburn should be able to turn them into SEC caliber tackles that can play well week in and week out. It's just a matter of, can they? Can the coaching staff get them to perform like that? And last year we saw with guys like Percy Lewis, things not necessarily work out. And he, for all intents and purposes, he was a bust.
I haven't heard that name in a while.
I hope
Lane Kiffin's going to turn him into a goat, though.
Yeah, probably. I hope that Chaplin and Murphy are able to take that next step. Because, to be honest with you, Auburn's interior is proven. Connor Lue is one of the best centers in the SEC. Dylan Wade, it can play just about anywhere. One of the best offensive linemen, period, in the SEC. Jeremiah Wright, very experienced, physical guy that I think will be great inside at guard. Auburn has, on paper, one of the better offensive lines in this league. It's just a matter of, can they perform?
It's hard to throw the term good onto a team just because you don't – that word good can mean so many different things based off the question, but how good can this offensive line be? And then following that, how good do they have to be for Auburn to have – success on the offensive side of the football? I mean, are we expecting, I think it better be the expectation for them to be a top 10 group in the Southeastern Conference. And I think if you want to have true success, you need to be at worst in the top 8, if not the top 5, at least have some sort of conversation to being in that top or second tier to allow the offense to work, and then you allow the defense to take over like you know they will.
So last season, Auburn was 8th in the SEC in total sacks. They gave up 2.25 sacks per game. They were 6th in this league in tackles for loss, total tackles for loss. They gave up 5.25 per contest. With the additions on paper, you would expect them to be a top 5, top 3 type unit, right?
I mean, Wow. Say those again. You were top eight.
Auburn was eighth in sacks allowed, total sacks allowed. They were sixth in tackles for loss allowed.
So dead even.
Right. So that you should, with the additions at tackle, if they are better than what you had last season, which I would venture a guess after watching practice, they're going to be at least a little bit better. Auburn should have a top five offensive line in this conference. And I Man. Think that is, you know, where you when you start to ask the question, what is it going to take to have for this offense to have the overall success that we think it can because of the passing game, because of the quarterbacks, because of, honestly, guys like Damari Alston and guys like Omar Mabson who have been stepping up in fall camp. I think the offensive line can get there and they can reach that ceiling. Based on the statistics we had a season ago, they should improve.
Man. Auburn should have a top five offensive line.
Should.
In the conference. How many years have we said that in a row? Or how many years has it been, man, the success is right there. This team should be really good if they lean on their offensive line.
I don't necessarily, to be honest with you, I feel like it's been a hot minute since we've, like, seen that because of just how bad offensive line recruiting has been. Like, ever since Hugh Freeze, like, before Hugh Freeze got here, for 5-6 years, the story was Auburn is either not recruiting offensive linemen or they can't get the high-profile guys that can make this thing work. I mean, if you remember, wasn't Jeremiah Wright, like, flipping back and forth between mm-hmm. defensive line, like, for years? Like, this guy is not your traditional offensive guard. The Tigers have not had a good O-line, I think, in forever. Like, since those early Gus Malzahn days. I think if you get it this year, man, it all starts in the trenches, as every coach and any fan wants to tell you in the SEC, starts in the trenches. I think Auburn, again, on paper, it's all hypothetical. It's what frustrates me so much about Auburn is that on, like, when you look at the individual talents and the player ranking systems and the star ratings, it's like, okay, these guys are good enough to compete. It's just a matter of whether or not the coaching staff, Jake Thorne, Hugh Freeze, et cetera, can actually get them to perform to that level. And Auburn's, I don't feel like they've seen that in years. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I don't feel like we've seen the them reach that potential.
I feel like it's much more of this team or this offensive line is much improved. We should see a big jump, and then you feel like that
and it never happens,
never comes to fruition.
Yeah.
Question for you on the way out. It was something we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and I feel like it relates perfectly to the conversation we're having right now. Does Auburn feel pressure for Mason Murphy and for Xavier Chaplin to work out and to get those draft grades and to get the draft stock and work their way into the NFL, not quite to form that pipeline of offensive linemen to the NFL, but just to be able to have some sort of, hey, look what we were able to do with, yes, the freshmen that we come in from the high school or we brought in from the high school ranks, but also some of these transfers in as well. You can have success regardless of when you decide to come in.
Yeah, I think Auburn should feel pressure from a bunch of different perspectives here. First and foremost, like you said, the ability to sell yourself to any transfer portal kids. Like, we will put you in a good position to succeed, and you will be able to come into the best league in the nation and perform well. We've got the coaching staff and the scheme to make you look better, and we can prove it this year with guys like Chaplin and Murphy. The other thing here is, as far as this year goes, I think Auburn should feel pressure for these guys to work out, because I'm not so sure if I am uber confident in the backup options that Auburn has at left and right tackle. Do you feel confident in Tuttle? Do you feel confident in Tyler Johnson? Based on what I've seen in camp, they're getting turned around by guys like Keldrick Falk and Kieron Crawford. I mean, they are getting worked.
We talked about Jared Smith, too, when we were watching him in the end zone on Saturday and how it was just that go get the ball.
Right.
And oh, my gosh.
And by the way, that's not to say Miller or Johnson are bad players. It's just there's a reason that they're not starting, or they weren't, like, tabbed as guys that are going to be your top options at tackle. That's why Auburn went out and got portal players to begin with. So Auburn should feel pressure for these guys to work. Absolutely.
Auburn feeling the pressure, and man, we are coming up close. We are 24 days until Auburn football. We are 32 days until Auburn football is inside Jordan-Hare Stadium. But going back to 24 days before Auburn and Baylor kick it off in Waco, and the betting lines, man, they feel like they don't know what to do. This is the epitome, the exact definition, or at least according to the people, of a complete pick'em, a toss-up game, and that's where we go when we come back, because we're just off and running here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin. If you want to be on the line, call 334-321-1390 or text 334-784-1067.
Back inside the studio, we continue on here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. He is Lance Dahl. I'm Christian Griffin. No Jacob Goins here. He'll be back with us tomorrow in this seat. And looking forward to having him back and being able to talk to him about some of the thoughts that he had about fall camp. And we just finished up a really good conversation about the offensive line unit. And we have a few minutes here before we get to Lindsey Crosby to talk a little bit of Major League Baseball. Man, we were talking about this before going on air and how the betting lines for this Auburn-Baylor game on Friday, August 29th, inside Waco, the blackouts, it's a crazy game, a crazy setup game for both of these teams, what it could mean. Auburn, a 1.5-point favorite to start. Then all of a sudden the news came out that just about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago, it completely flipped, and Baylor became a 1.5-point favorite. Auburn made its way into the underdog spot. And now you look at it, and you feel like you can go and get 2 points just about anywhere you look.
Yep. Across, like, either way.
Yes.
It's bizarre to me. I wrote a piece for The Barn here probably 4 or 5 days ago, just giving my general thoughts on the betting line to start and then just, like, this Baylor team as a whole. I never quite understood, and when I wrote this last Friday, I said I never quite understood why Auburn was favored by 1.5 because of just how much respect I have for this Baylor team.
Sure.
And what they're bringing back. But as things have kind of flipped back and forth and you dive into what Auburn's going to be this season, after actually getting to see more of this team play, diving more into what Baylor's going to have in the defensive backfield, you know, you could go either way with this. And I feel like you're seeing that reflected in betting lines. And when you look at what this Auburn team is just offensively, you know, I think, like we just mentioned, the offense should score, like on paper, we should score points. It's just a matter of whether or not you can find a consistent rhythm on the road on a Friday night in Waco, Texas. So
simple game, really.
Just
score points.
Just score points, man. The thing about Baylor, just real quick, starters are back for an offense that finished 22nd nationally in yards per play last season. You could probably throw that stat out if you wanted to, because like I mentioned, Auburn went 5-7 and was ninth. They were sixth in the country in plays of 20-plus yards, fourth in plays of 30-plus yards. They also weren't just explosive. They were very balanced in doing so. They ran the ball very well. Bryson Washington is incredible. Jake Spavadal is a really good offensive coordinator. Sawyer Robertson is good. But the problem is they scored all these points and they had all these yards against some really bad Big 12 teams. The Big 12 just wasn't very good at playing defense last year. Shocker. That's how it's always been. And despite what people want to say, like, oh, they're running the football now. Yeah, they're still giving up yards, like a ton of yards per game and a ton of points. But I digress. You can throw stats out the window. You could say, forget it for Auburn and for Baylor. Here's the thing. They have what, like the fourth best odds to win the Big 12? Like, who cares? It's a crapshoot every year in the Big 12. Arizona State had the worst odds a season ago.
Yeah, they're projected to finish last.
Yeah, they were dead last in preseason SP Plus, and yet they won the league.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares what stats say about Auburn, about Baylor, what betting lines say about Auburn, about Baylor? I think you could make the argument, which I'm trying to, that you genuinely don't know what the crap is going to happen in this game. We can throw out stats. We can throw out players. We can throw out experience. We have no idea what Auburn, with all of their new pieces and all their new shiny toys on offense and their improved defensive front, which I think and experience in the back, like we could talk about, it doesn't matter. We just need to see these two teams play. And I think the fact that nobody really knows what's going to happen is reflected in what Vegas is currently throwing out there. I am stressed about this game because I can't pick a side. I'm flip-flopping day in and day out about how I feel about Baylor as a team. Like, who cares what stats say about them? Who cares? It's a Big 12 opponent. There, you're gonna walk in and you're gonna see just like chaos there in Waco. You're probably gonna see a mascot on crack. Like, it's gonna be insane. It's going to be a weird environment.
It's very weird. I mean, again, the Friday night, it's a blackout. For those that haven't seen it, their student section does not go up like most SEC schools do.
Yeah.
Their student section looks like Neville Arena, if that's a halfway decent comparison. It is it works its way along the sideline. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really cool, and you feel like that affects the crowd volume as well from the standpoint of the horseshoe. But, yeah, I mean, you sit there and look at it, and it's, okay, I'm happy that Auburn's an underdog, right? That they should be the underdog. What has Auburn done to prove it? Then you go and look at just certain statistics, and I know we're saying to throw them out, but the more we sit here and actually look at this team, and we look at them in fall camp, and we see the speed and the size, you hear what Coach Freeze is having to say about them. Again, it's not an arrogance, but it's a confidence on, man, yeah, this is what this team should be able to do. Yeah, the sports books are very, very reflective. When we started the conversation, I was sitting there talking about how Auburn was, you know, a point and a half underdog, and then you were showing me an unnamed sports book and how, you know, Auburn's now the 1-point favorite again. And so they really do have absolutely no idea. And in a weird way, yeah, it feels like that stresses you out more than the line just sitting at Baylor plus 2.5.
And if you want to argue more in Auburn's favor, look back to 2023. First two home games of the season, you lose to TJ Finley and Texas State. You follow that up with a game against number 12 Utah, you lose 20-13. End of that game was chaotic. Baylor should have found a way to win that game, and they botched it. They have not had... Their most recent, like, decent win at home was against TCU in November last season. They have not had a good home win in over 2 years. You could say they're due, or you could say, no, Auburn should go in there and beat them by 14+. I have no idea what's going to happen, and I don't like thinking about it because it stresses me out.
It does. It hurts to think about, but it's exciting to think about.
I am so
but
excited.
It stresses you out to you lay in bed and you sit here and you're ready for the game, but you're anxiously optimistic,
yes,
about how you hope how it should go on a Friday night in Waco, Texas. Man, Auburn 63% blue chip ratio, Baylor 14.29. You feel like that in itself should explain a whole lot. We flip over to the baseball diamond because the Braves should have been good, but they just basically aren't. But they played a pretty cool game and actually got a win. We talk about that with Lindsey Crosby coming up next.
You're 30 minutes into On the Line on ESPN 106.7. Now back to the studio with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin.
That graphic lied. No Jacob Goins in the studio today. Christian Griffin and Lance Dahl here with you in the ESPN 106.7 studio. 30 minutes in to the Tuesday edition of On the Line. And we flip over to the baseball diamond, or possibly over to the racetrack. And as we get Lindsey Crosby, host of Braves Today, the Locked On Braves postcast, and a rider for the barn as well. Lindsey, you weren't able to go to Bristol Motor Speedway, were you?
I was not, and it turns out it was a good thing that I wasn't
very
there
much
because
so.
It was a nightmare for everybody involved.
It looked absolutely brutal, and I know that you were tweeting out of, man, if this was a possibility of delaying it, why are we playing half of an inning before the rain delay? But before we dive into the game, what were your thoughts on, man, the ability to make this happen? Again, it was supposed to be shattering the MLB attendance record, and it looked like it could have been up until the rain, but you feel like the idea was at least there.
Oh, yeah, the concept was super cool, and we've seen other sports come into Bristol before. Virginia and Tennessee played a college football game there. That one made a little bit more sense if you think about those two schools and where Bristol's located. But the concept is completely sound. The visuals look pretty cool on television. It's just the fan experience, from the fan zone outside to the lack of concessions. I mean, who wants to pay full price for a hot dog without the bun or nachos without the cheese, right? Obviously, the rain delay and all of that stuff. So the fan experience wasn't great if you're there, but on television, it looked super cool.
Yeah, we saw a bunch of the anytime anybody threw above 95, it showed the race car as it showed up the flames with the miles per hour. But yeah, hearing about running out of concessions and trying to find spots to cover up with the rain, you feel like, again, if the idea was to push it, or the option was there to push it to the afternoon game, I mean, why not? You had Austin Riley dive into a lake in the home half of the first inning, trying to stop a ball going into left field. No injuries the night of the game until you got it postponed. And Austin Riley does end up getting injured, trying to tag out, or I guess successfully tagging out, Ellie De La Cruz at home. What is his status right now, Mr. Austin Riley?
So, actually, fun fact, he told the media yesterday that he first re-injured himself on that dive into the lake on Saturday.
Oh, gosh.
But when he warmed up on Sunday, he stretched and everything, he felt fine. And then when he landed hard on that Ellie De La Cruz tag, he said, okay, yeah, no, it's definitely still hurting. And that's when they went made the decision to pull him. But he is going to take it kind of day by day. They think it's going to be longer than the last IL stint. He was out about 2 weeks last time. And their goal here is they want to avoid a recurrence. So there's no formal time frame, but they've kind of been banning about a month or so, which gives us time to see what Nacho Alvarez can do against major league pitching. He's Atlanta's top position player prospect, according to most rankings, has mostly played third base, tried shortstop. It wasn't working out. They think maybe he can cover some second like he did last year, but he's going to be back up. The glove has looked really good at third. The offense hasn't really been there until he got that double last night. So we get a month of watching him against major league pitching, and then assuming everybody's healthy, we get a month of him in AAA playing second base like he did after he went back down to see if maybe he could be ready to possibly take over for Ozzie Albies next year.
What was – you said a word in there. Did you say healthy? Is that what you – you said that in the Braves in the same
– healthy.
The same sentence, huh? Trying to figure out.
Yeah, if everybody's healthy. That's the fun one. We actually got a bunch of updates on the pitchers yesterday, and the long story short is most of them are probably not going to be coming back this year based on health. Chris Sale's throwing bullpens, right? They're going to get the live BP soon. But Spencer Schwellenbach hasn't thrown yet. Ronaldo Lopez is only playing catch. Grant Holmes is going to try to rest and have rehab on his partial UCL tear rather than actually having Tommy John right now. So Atlanta may get one of those pitchers back instead of getting back, you know, four or three, even three of them.
What about Ronald Acuna Jr.? I know that they said that there was no true timeline. Do you expect him to wear a Braves jersey again this season, or do you expect that to fully be the mindset for 2026?
No, he's going to be back. He hit in the cages last night before the game. He wasn't taking BP on the field, but he's in the cage in a more controlled environment, taking swings and everything. He is still feeling some tenderness in the calf, and they want to wait until there's nothing there at all before they let him come back. Part of the issue they had with the injury was he felt it a little bit, and they sent him back out there the next day after the training staff said he's probably okay, and he wasn't okay. So I do expect him to come back. It may take a couple more weeks, right? And I think you're at the point of there's no reason to rush him simply because you have nothing left to play for, right? If you were approaching the postseason and you were getting ready to start, you know, in the wild card round, the divisional round, whatever, you'd be hurrying to try to get him ready by next week or so. But I think in this situation, they'll take it slow. I do expect to see him before the end of August, though.
You see the trade deadline come and go. Braves make absolutely no moves. Lindsay, my only question to you is, what the hell, man? What are we doing? Like, what is the plan after making no moves, no nothing? I think you actually wrote about this at Braves Today, like trying to explain like why Atlanta did nothing. Explain to me why on earth Atlanta just feels content to sit back and just let all of this happen.
I love the plug. Thank you for BravesToday.com. And just so it's on the record, Lance Dahl has been one of the very first subscribers to Braves Today. And I can see how often people read these things. Lance is one of the most dedicated readers of Braves Today, so thank you, Lance. That's actually been one of our most popular articles we've ever written, was about why the Atlanta Braves didn't do business at the trade deadline. And Alex Anthopoulos, well, I hopped on a Zoom with him and a bunch of other people. It wasn't just two of us. But he made it sound like the offers just really weren't there. They did not want to trade Marcell Ozuna and Raisel Iglesias just for the sake of moving them, right? Just to dump a little bit of salary, because they already had that money put aside. They do value the leadership, the veteran leadership of both those guys, and they wanted to get some sort of asset that could help with 2026. And this quote that stood out to me is when he said, I can't make a trade. It takes two people to do a trade. And that right there, that statement tells me that he didn't really have an offer that was anything more than, we'll send you this person that we just DFA'd so you can DFA them yourself. And so he said, I'll keep these guys. And when you look at Marcelo Ozuna specifically, you look at him, so many players have talked to us in the last two or three seasons about how Marcelo Ozuna helped them through a slump or through issues. Michael Harris last year. Heck, Chris Sale early this year talked about how Marcelo Ozuna helped him when he started the year off poorly. So Atlanta's obviously banking on, we're going to keep these veterans. They're going to help us keep the clubhouse together. They're going to help us fix whatever problems are ailing us so that we can be competitive next year. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I understand from that perspective.
Right. So Atlanta's injury situation, right? I mean, the entire pitching staff from day one has just been struggling to stay healthy. It's been like that for what feels like several years. Is it injury luck, Lindsay? Is it just the Braves are just really unlucky with the stretch of injuries that they've had for several seasons? Is it something that they're doing wrong when it comes to strength and conditioning? What can they do to try and change some of these fortunes just to get their best players consistently healthy?
That's a really good question. I think that there's been two kinds of injuries that the Braves have dealt with in recent years. And to your point, all five opening day starters on the 60-day IL, it's the first time I've ever seen that in baseball. I'm sure it's happened before, but it's the first time I've ever seen it. And the two types of injuries that they have is they're having the injuries that are the typical injuries you see with pitching. The Grant Holmes torn UCL, the AJ Smith-Shawver torn UCL. Every year, you're going to lose some number of starting pitchers to a UCL tear. It's just that's modern baseball. Typically, it doesn't hit multiple guys on your major league staff, right? But you'll have a couple minor leaguers who go down, and in the organization, it's probably 3, 4, maybe 5 guys a year who are going to have the surgery. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is Atlanta's had really weird kind of fluky injuries, and those are the ones I think are more bad luck. Chris Sale going back out for the 9th, trying to get the complete game. He dives to make a stop on a grounder, and he lands funny, and he fractures his rib cage. That's a fluke injury. That's not something that's pitching related. That's just kind of bad luck, right? Spencer Schwellenbach has an elbow injury. He believes it's from trying to ramp up his velocity, but it's like a fracture in his elbow. That's not inherently anything the Braves training staff did wrong. That's just kind of bad luck with that. And it feels like a lot of what Atlanta's dealing with, Ronaldo Lopez, the shoulder issue. He's also had forearm issues in the last 2 years. He's had 3 injured list stints. This feels like it's kind of bad luck. And you have a certain amount of depth in your organization at any given time. The Braves have used between 10 and 13 regular starters every year. This is now the 5th straight year they've done that, right? But it feels like this is a concentration at the very top. You look at the guys you lost your 5 best starters, right? You didn't lose depth guys who were 8th and 9th on that pecking order. You lost number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5. And so in a normal season, Atlanta's going to lose somebody, and they'll get through it okay. They lost Lopez last year. They lost Max Fried for over 3 months in 23. They made it through okay. But this is just a combination of bad luck and poor timing with a lot of these.
Last question from me. If I had told you at the beginning of the season that in early August the Braves would be 8 games behind the Marlins, what would that have done to you emotionally? Because right now it's wrecking me.
It probably would have made me regret agreeing to do a post-game show for every single Braves game this year, you had told me that. Somebody said that they felt really bad for me that I go live and talk for 20 minutes after every single game. And I said, well, the plus side is, like, I'm getting paid to do that. Right. You're doing this. You're just watching, and you're not getting paid to watch the game and then watch me talk about it. It would have been really hard. I would have assumed that something drastic had happened, like those pitching injuries, right? You would have lost a lot of players. I think the surprising thing to me is that Atlanta was already out of it before the pitching injuries started.
Yeah.
Right? The pitching injuries, the rotation. Last year, Atlanta's rotation was the best in baseball by ERA. They beat the Seattle Mariners by like 1/10 of a run. and Atlanta was barely over 500, barely made the postseason. And this year, with all of the injuries, you don't have that to make up for an underperforming offense. And so now the question is, can you, over the last 2 months, fix the offense so that if your pitching staff gets back into top 10 range in baseball, which it looks like you absolutely could, especially if you address it in the offseason, you can get back to being a World Series or division contending team versus the second best odds as of this morning at getting the number one overall pick in the draft from the lottery.
I was going to ask if there was any sort of good news, but I feel like that might be the best news to cling on to right now. We're talking with Lindsey Crosby of Braves Today. And Lindsey, I'm kind of throwing you into the fire with this. I can think of at least two times, and although that doesn't feel like a lot, the fact that it's happened twice is kind of crazy, of the Braves hitting a leadoff homer and that being their only run of the game. Has that happened more than just twice? Because I know it happened with Ronald's return as well. Is there another time this year, or is there any sort of stat on how crazy those odds are and the fact that it could only happen to the Atlanta Braves?
I mean, last night, Jurickson Profar hit a leadoff home run last night, and that was Atlanta's last run.
That's
of the game.
That was the second one I was thinking.
Okay, yeah. Like, it's both teams had three hits, and they had one homer, but Milwaukee's homer came with two men on base.
Awesome.
Atlanta's came on the very first pitch. I think if you look at how many first pitch leadoff homers, I don't think there's very many that are more than two or three in a season. Atlanta obviously has two this year, but leadoff homers, I think that's a little more common. And then that's the sign of the Braves offense, right? Is they get that leadoff homer, they don't do anything else after it. I will look into that before I get on the next time, but I'm willing to bet that the Braves have the record for the most first pitch home runs of a game. And then it's a shutout after that point, simply because there's no way anybody could be worse at that than Atlanta. That's very Atlanta Braves stat is, hey, first pitch, we're going to launch it. And then we're just not going to do anything offensively for the rest of the game.
Look at there. The Braves do win some sort of category. Maybe not the ones you want to win, but the Braves are first at scoring and not scoring again.
Speaking of winning, they also have the best winning percentage in MLB history in the state of Tennessee.
Hey, there you go.
Because they won at Bristol on Sunday.
Never
lost.
There we go. And Eli White has two mammoth bombs in the state of Tennessee.
The only MLB player to ever homer in the state of Tennessee.
That's pretty incredible. Pretty incredible. Lindsey, we appreciate it as always, man. Plug everything you got. I mean, plug how exciting the Braves postcast is just about every single night.
All right. So, as he said, Locked On Braves postcast, part of Locked On Sports Atlanta. Me and Jake Mastriani, host of Locked On Braves. We're finding the positives. And we're having some fun with these games, right? We talked about cutters and how slow the lineup was last night. So, like, come join that after every single Braves game. BravesToday.com, both a newsletter and a podcast every single day in your inboxes on YouTube and where you get your podcasts. You can follow me on social media at Crosby Baseball. And then there is Auburn baseball content, too, thebarnauburn.com.
Lindsey, appreciate it as always. We'll get you back into the studio here before too long. All right, my friend?
Looking forward to it, boys. Thanks.
That's Lindsey Crosby, host of the Locked On Braves postcast. And, man, what a time it is for Mr. Lindsey Crosby having to get on there and talk about the Jurickson Profar solo home run. I saw him tweet about it, and it was a 93.6-mile-an-hour cutter, middle-middle, and he said that doesn't miss too many barrels. And that was the one barrel that they truly found last night as the Braves fall to 47-64.
Beautiful.
What more could you ask for, right?
Really nothing, honestly, just for one pitcher to stay healthy or just something like that.
Braves had like a 90.9% chance of making the postseason, and we're the second behind the Dodgers in World Series odds to get this season started.
Incredible.
Does Jabba work its way over to the Braves?
You know, it probably – ever since Auburn rolled Toomers after they won the World Series, it's probably some mix of bad luck between the two.
It started before that. I'll die on this tree.
When
it happened before – oh, man, what a conversation here. It happens when Toomers got rolled before Kyle Guy got fouled.
Oh, you know what? You're probably
because there
right.
were like three people that went and rolled Toomers' corner right before the three ball in the corner where Samir Dowdy tried to hold back but made a little contact with his leg. He knocked down both or all three free throws. That was the moment right there.
We should exile those people from Auburn, Alabama.
We will find you, Liam Neeson style.
I will say this about Braves today. It is the only place I go to get Braves coverage. Like, literally, the only place I'll go to read what Lindsay has to say, because he does an incredible job of breaking down stats, because I'm a huge nerd stats guy. And anytime I get frustrated just with how the Braves are performing, he's always got something in the inbox breaking down either the previous night's performance or just how they are playing overall.
It's
therapeutic.
If you're frustrated with stats, I mean, that's about nightly. So you're reading a lot of Braves Today coverage from Lindsey Crosby.
We usually run it by the stats and info department quite often, and they just come back screaming and crying. It's just awful.
Kicking and screaming, baby. Kicking and screaming. Braves fall to 47-64. We're going to take our break, come back, have a very short segment, maybe talk about some of the NLE standings, or for all you know, maybe we don't talk about the NLE standings because it'll bring more pain to us. But we wrap up hour number one after this.
You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin, online at ESPNAU.com and on the Radio Alabama app.
Wrapping up hour number one here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. Appreciate everybody for being here with us on ESPN 106.7. And appreciate good buddy of ours, Lindsey Crosby, host of Braves Today, the Locked On Braves postcast, and also a writer with The Bar, man. He does absolutely fantastic coverage. I would never call him a nerd in an insult way, but I feel like I'm a baseball nerd, and it's absolutely nothing in comparison to Lindsey Crosby. I mean, if there is somebody that you want that lives, breathes, and eats baseball, whether that is college baseball, whether that is pro level, any sort of minor league, single A, high A, double A, anything like that, overseas baseball, that's the guy that you need to go to. And Lance, while we have just a moment or two, I know baseball is very much your forte and you love it more than any other sport in the entire world, but is there a team looking at some of the standings that surprises you when you're looking at whether that's the American League or the National League?
I got three things for you, Christian. Number one, looking at the Braves sitting here fourth in the NL East makes me want to do things I can't say on air. But I'll say this. If Auburn doesn't get a win over Baylor week one, I'm going to come in here Monday uninvited and scream into the microphone for like two straight hours.
Please do.
No break.
You will be fully welcomed, actually.
You can take calls. Just put them on. All they'll hear is me screaming. That's all they're going to get. That's the first thing.
No literate conversations will be happening on that Monday with Lance Dahl.
No, I will come in. First of all, as sober as anybody has ever been, but still out of my mind, if you catch my drift. Second thing here, Cubs, my secondary team. I'm really glad that they're doing well. The offense has been incredible this season. I hate that they're having to contend in the NL Central with the Brewers, who are just playing out of their freaking minds right now.
They
had
really
like a 10-game winning streak here recently. And then the third thing, I think it's beautiful. I think most baseball fans would agree this is a beautiful thing. Yankees are 5.5 games back in the AL East. That's just every time I look at it, I laugh.
What more could you ask for? 4-6 in their last 10.
Beautiful.
Red Sox are 8-2.
Swept by the Marlins for the first time ever, by the way.
Beautiful. Beautifully done. Brewers, good thing your Cubs can gain some ground because they're playing the Braves. And, you know, Brewers won last night, so I'm sure the Braves will show a lot of fight here tonight and tomorrow.
Sure.
Hour number one is in the books. When we come back, hour number two, we're talking some more coaches preseason, the top 25 coaches poll. Also, John Rothstein thanking America and says that it's not anarchy, it's just common sense. Don't you dare turn that radio dial. Hour number two is coming up after this.
The following is an Auburn Network production. You are on the line, live on ESPN 106.7. ESPNAU.com and the Radio Alabama app. To be on the line, call 334-321-1390 or text 334-784-1067. Bringing you the insight and passion surrounding Auburn athletics, the SEC, and more. This is what Sports Talk Radio should be. Lock it in right here on Auburn Opelika's sports leader, ESPN 1067. Now, live from Auburn, Alabama, with the guys who tell it like it is and hold nothing back. You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin.
You're on the line here on ESPN 1067, Auburn Opelika sports leader. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope you're doing well as we get you started with hour number two here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. I am Christian Griffin. He is Lance Dahl. Appreciate everybody for being here with us. Whether you're tuning in right now or whether you've been with us for the entire show, man, we appreciate it. A fantastic hour number one, man. We got to talk some Auburn football fall camp. We got to talk a little bit more about the freshmen, and we got to dive into the offensive line and use our favorite word on, man, how good should this team be? How good should this group be? And how good will they need to be for Auburn to have success on the offensive side of the football? We also got to dive into the August 29th date with Baylor and how the betting lines just continue to change. You wake up one day and it says this. You wake up on another day and it says this. You even open two of these unnamed sports books at the exact same time, and you could see a 2 or a 3 point change. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and I'm sure that that brings a whole lot of ease to both the Auburn and the Baylor fan base. And we got all of that before we talked with Lindsey Crosby, host of Braves Today, the Locked On Braves postcast, and part of the Barn Auburn. We got to talk to him about the Speedway Classic with the Braves and the Reds. Lance asked him why the Braves are quite literally trying to be poked with a stick, doing absolutely nothing, and then just what the future of the Braves looks like. We then talked a little bit of MLB standings, all of that in hour number one. If you missed any of it, you can check it out in the podcast or on the podcast forum in the podcast center on ESPNAU.com.
And in hour number two, stick with me, guys. We got a lot of stuff on tap. The first coaches poll, top 25 for college football, has been released. This is going to give me an opportunity to be a hater here against a lot of teams, maybe some you root for. Also, John Rothstein thanking America. There will be no expansion, at least for now, in the world of NCAA basketball. It will not expand. The field will not for March Madness in 2026. This is objectively a good thing, but is expansion inevitable for college basketball, college football, or just in general, because the money hoarding people across TV networks are going to force it to be so.
Stop. No.
It's going to happen.
They do it for the love of basketball, right? they agreed on no expansion because they said, you know what? We all love college basketball, and we think that's better for the fans. There's no other incentive. There's no other motivators. It's simply for love.
What even is a dollar? I just love basketball.
I love the squeaky shoes, man. I love the sound of the net just ripping on a three-pointer. That's what brings me and my family food.
What is the old song? I love them dribbling up and down the court or whatever that old basketball song.
They're playing basketball.
Yeah, I don't know. But that, yeah, the expansion might be
inevitable. We'll get that on a hotkey. We're going to play that here at 2:30 as soon as we start talking a little bit of college basketball. But we talked a little bit about it yesterday in the coaches poll, the top 25. We're going to break down this list rather quickly and just kind of talk about it. Just react to the top 25 list. Again, yesterday it was more of the announcing who is placed where. But Lance, I know that you have some very, very strong opinions about some of these teams. This is the first time that you have seen it. And so we'll go rather quickly again, just by five teams at a time. And again, if you would like to join in on this conversation, the phone lines are open. No text box here today with Jacob Goins out of town. He'll be back with us tomorrow afternoon. But the phone lines are open if you would like to be a part of the show. You would like to be on the line. That number is 334-321-1390. Again, 334-321-1390. And again, going rather fast before we break these down. 25 through 21, Boise State, Texas Tech, BYU, Iowa State, Texas A&M. Kansas State at 20, Indiana at 19, Tennessee and Florida at 18 and 17, SMU at 16. We'll start with those first 10. Is there a team? I asked Jack this yesterday. Is there a team that's surprising to you as of right now? Again, we'll dive in. Excuse me. Dive into the questions a little bit on a team that won't stay and a team that's not ranked that will be in the top 25. But a team as of right now that you're a little bit surprised seeing that much love here early on.
I think there are two different teams I'm looking at that I'm kind of surprised they're getting the love that they are. At number 25, I'm surprised that Boise State is here after losing Ashton Jeanty and him essentially being that entire offense, that entire team. Are they the best group of five team out there? I'm not sure that they are. I just don't know if they will be in this top 25 for long after debuting here in this coaches poll at number 25. And then Tennessee at number 18. After losing Nico, after having to replace so much in that receiver room, there have been some questions about that during camp, yes, wondering about what they're going to do across the defensive front. I just don't know if Tennessee deserves to be a top 20 squad. I'd probably swap them with Boise State, not swap. I'd probably put them at the bottom there at number 25. I just don't think right now they're a top 20 team. You could probably say the same about Florida if you wanted to, just because of like maybe their top 20 caliber, but their schedule is not, they're not going to be a top 20 team by the end of the year because everybody's just going to beat up on them.
It's funny that you mentioned Tennessee because that was one of the teams that I mentioned with Jack yesterday about how I feel like that's a little bit surprising. And he sat there and talked about, yes, it's, you know, you lost your quarterback and have such a battle, but this is still a team that went to the college football playoff. And it's so funny to think about because you feel like that's the team that everybody completely forgot about being in the playoff. You have to go and remind yourself, yeah, they did. They went and played in, yep, Columbus, and well, I don't know if played is the right word, but
they participated.
They drove up there and got to watch Ohio State do all sorts of, you know what, to their team on the football field. That was one of the teams that I had mentioned as well. And again, this goes back to the entire conversation you're talking about on, yeah, the roster and the talent is there with Florida, but man, what is the record going to look like? I stand by this opinion, and we've had a couple people agree it would never happen, but man, the first voting is the college football playoff rankings. Those are the top 25 votings. That way, there's no top 25 wins that Georgia Tech was able to get over Florida State and Dublin, Ireland, when Florida State wins, yeah, three games. But yet, that's still something that Georgia Tech can say of, yeah, well, we had four top 25 wins on our schedule. You feel like this conversation obviously works its way in to the coaches' poll top 25 that we're talking about right now. Again, this is via USA Today, a little graphic in an article that On3 put out, but for the sake of talking season that you feel like you're still somewhat in, you're looking at these 25 logos right now, and that's kind of where you stand. You dive into the top 15. Ole Miss is the 15th ranked team in the country. The Wolverines of Michigan at 14, South Carolina, Illinois, and Arizona State 13 through 11. We talked about how funny it would be yesterday if South Carolina was 12 and Illinois was 13 just because of the dramatics that happened in that rivalry. Is there any team in that five that stands out to you, whether that's good or bad?
Michigan. I just don't, right now, I just don't see them as a top 15 squad.
Yes.
Could they be a top 25 team? Probably. I think you could make a case for that, especially after seeing the way that they just manhandled Alabama in their bowl a season ago. But I just don't have that much confidence in Bryce Underwood year one. I don't know if I have a ton of confidence in Sherrone Moore to get this team to a top 15 kind of caliber season. Of course, their schedule is going to allow them many opportunities to just kind of cruise through and get to that point. But it's as far as like caliber, it's the same thing with Florida. Like it's the opposite of Florida, rather, I should say, where like you have the talent to be, for Florida, you have the talent to be a really good team. possibly a top 15 squad in the nation just in terms of like what you have on roster, but your schedule's not going to allow you to get there at the end of the season. Opposite case for Michigan. I don't necessarily know if you have the talent to be a top 15 team, but your schedule, you've got games against Oklahoma, Nebraska, Wisconsin, USC, Washington, Michigan State, Purdue, Northwestern, Maryland before you play Ohio State there at the end of the season. I mean, just not a lot of those games inspire like any sort of difficulty for you. So Michigan is my team here that I'm just like, I don't necessarily know if they should be 14.
We were talking about this yesterday, and again, Michigan was a team that I specifically brought up, and I said, bring this conversation back up Monday after week two, right? Michigan going to Norman playing Oklahoma. You're going to mm-hmm. learn a lot about both of those teams. You're going to learn a lot about the Michigan offense. You're going to learn a lot about the Oklahoma offense.
Yeah.
With John Mateer and Jade Nott, again, should have all the talent in the world, but those two teams in that game is going to tell me a whole lot. And then you work your way into the top 10, again, before we kind of break this down as a whole. And we made the joke yesterday on, man, you feel like you could throw these 10 logos in any sort of top 10 just about every single year. And you could honestly, if you're the coaches poll, if you're USA Today, man, put Notre Dame at 8 and put Alabama at 5 and just let the world respond to that and get all of the clicks, all of the engagement. It would be absolutely genius. But the top 10, Miami, LSU, Alabama at 8, Oregon at 7, Clemson at 6, Notre Dame at 5, Georgia at 4, Penn State at 3, Ohio State at 2, and Steve Sarkisian and the Texas Longhorns as the number one team scheduled in the preseason coaches poll top 25.
There you go. I've got some qualms with some of these teams, man. I'm looking at it, and there are a lot of these teams that I just have questions about that, like, I guess the question you would ask in response to, like, some of my problems with these squads is like, okay, well then who would you have ranked? And I mean
Auburn,
you know, we'll get to that in a second.
Top 10, baby.
I've got some thoughts on that, but yeah, no, like you said, like you could probably shuffle this top 10 in any way, shape, or form outside of maybe having Miami in the top 3, and you could probably be like, fine,
enough to have some sort of engagement conversation on, well, this could be the case.
Yeah, absolutely.
The question that I had, and I asked Jack about this yesterday, and we kind of thought about it off air and talked a little bit more about it, but when you're looking into the top 10, you feel like there's two different sides of the spectrum. It's the teams that have the yes quarterbacks, the guys that have been there, whether that's at that team, whether that's just in college football for quite some time. And then there's the teams that have a whole lot of question marks on the quarterback side of things. You think of Miami, it's Carson Beck. You think of LSU with Garrett Nussmeier. You think Alabama. Okay, you throw them onto that other side. Oregon, you have Dante Moore, but I'm still pushing them into the question mark because you haven't seen too much of him after sitting out for a year behind Dylan Gabriel. Cade Klubnik with Clemson. Okay, yeah, you're putting him into that category. Notre Dame, they don't even know who they're going to run out there for week one. Gunnar Stockton, kind of in that similar situation with Dante Moore. I'm going to put them right on the fence for now. Drew Aller, yes, with Penn State, a quarterback. Is it going to be Julian Sayin with Ohio State? You feel like that's going to be the way, but there's more of a question mark. And then you have Arch Manning, who you feel like I can put on the fence with there as well. Texas and Georgia, to me, are the only two teams in the top 10 to where you feel like the coaching staff can will the quarterback to that ranking or to the playoff, to a national championship. And my question to you on that is, will a quarterback win a national title this year? And I don't mean that from the standpoint of, yeah, obviously a quarterback has to be decent enough. Yeah, obviously a quarterback's going to be on the team and win the national championship. But when you dive into the big picture, is the headline on the newspaper or on the ESPN article going to be Garrett Nussmeier in LSU win the national championship? Is it going to be Cade Klubnik and the LSU or the Clemson Tigers win a national championship? Is Drew Aller in Penn State, they win the national champion? Or is it going to be Kirby Smart in Georgia win the national championship and Gunnar Stockton does enough, but they rely on the run game and that defense? Is it going to be Texas and they don't need Arch Manning to do that much? Where do you fall in that conversation. Will a quarterback be the reason a team wins a national title?
I think the response to this is Will Howard is a national champion. Max Duggan almost got there. Stetson Bennett won two. The recent trend in college football, as you point out, it's not a quarterback leading the way. It's not Bryce Young. It's not Tua. It's not Joe Burrow. It is a more complete product from these high-end teams. And looking around this top 10, looking around the teams that could make that push, I think that almost all of them have some sort of complete roster. You look at a team like Penn State. I mean, Drew Aller is what he is, but if they're going to get to the top of the mountain, they're going to need the rest of that team, specifically the defensive front, to like continue to play at the level that they have. Texas is one of the most complete rosters in the country. They've got a great defense. They've got great pieces surrounding Arch Manning. If they win a title, it's probably going to be on the back of Steve Sarkisian as a coach and their talent roster. If Ohio State is going to do it, it's not going to be because of a quarterback. It might be because of their receiver room, but it's going to be because of the team as a whole. If Alabama does it, it's going to have a lot to do with what they have surrounding Ty Simpson or whoever wins that quarterback battle. It's a fascinating trend now in college football to where it's like the quarterback's not the star.
Which blows every sort of argument that Auburn's had completely out of the water over the past couple of years.
In what way?
Just the fact of we're a quarterback away.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which feels so weird to be able to say, but I think you're right.
Well, I think at the same time for Auburn, it's not necessarily like we're a quarterback away from like winning a title. I think it's like we're a quarterback away from like just being a competent team.
From making that jump.
But there are, I think that we can acknowledge, like there are like a bunch of different issues across the roster that also need to be, like we just mentioned in hour number one, the offensive line, I think, has to continue to get better. But, like, yeah, we're a quarterback away from being what we should be, which is a competent team that competes year in and year out. I think that there are a lot of things that Auburn has to continue to do to be a national championship squad. But, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's a good conversation to have as to what defines a champion in college football. It's funny, actually, recently I did a video on college basketball of over the past 20 years, what has defined a national champion in college basketball? And it shifted over the past several years, and I think that UConn is a perfect example of this over the last, like, whenever they won their back-to-back titles. It's a blend. It's not your five-star, throw out all the talent that you possibly can. It's a blend of portal kids that you find diamonds in the rough. It is some of those younger, high-profile recruits. It's some guys that you can get to stay around on the roster for several years. It's a blend. It's not necessarily one style of play that's going to get you close to the mountaintop or get you over the hump. For college football, I think you are starting to see it round out a little more, where it's not all about the skill position players. It's about what you're doing in the trenches. It's about what your coaching staff is able to bring to the table schematically. Yes, quarterback is still very important, but it's not everything. And some of these teams that have won titles as of late have proven that.
College football, you feel like right now is the circle of life, right? Where so much more matters. 5 years ago, it was who could be the best quarterback. How can you be the most electric player on the field? We're going to go and ride you and hope that you can put up 49 points a game. Before then, it was we're going to go win these games 13-9. Our defense and our run game is going to just be the dominant factor. Right now, you feel like you're kind of in the middle. You're trying to blend everything, and that's why I feel like you're seeing a lot of these teams in the top 10 just because of their total team roster. We're going to take our first break here in hour number two. When we come back, maybe a team or two that's ranked right now that will not be at the end of the season, and then a couple teams right now that aren't getting the love that we feel like will make their way into the top 25 when all things are said and done. We're off and running here on the Tuesday edition, or hour number two, rather, of the Tuesday edition of On the Line.
You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin. If you want to be on the line, call 334-321-1390 or text 334-784-1067.
All right, we're back here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. He is Lance Dahl. I'm Christian Griffin. No Jacob Goins. He'll be back with us tomorrow afternoon, but we're having a fun conversation breaking down the coaches poll top 25, and I feel like I had to alter the question just a little bit because during the break we were talking about some of these teams that may or may not make it either in the top 25 or won't stay in the top 25. And we kind of both said that the answer for the team that might not make it is Florida. But I feel like that's not a fair answer to the question. And so I feel like the rough draft versus the peer edit that I got from Mr. Lansdahl is much more of the which team is not going to pan out in the top 25. You feel like that has a little bit more validity to it because, yeah, Florida you feel like is the answer because they go 7-5, 8-4. They might not be in the top 25, but they still have all the talent in the world, and you feel like that's still a very successful season. So we'll start on that side of things, or would you rather start on a team or teams that will make it into the top 25? Let's start with that because yeah, I feel like you're a little more fired up and you might need a little bit of a break talking about the teams that won't stay in the top 25.
I've got two SEC teams here. I'm going to plead their case for a second that are not ranked right now that I think you could make an argument will find their way into the top 25 by the end of the season. Let's start with Missouri. Missouri right now is in the top 20, is in the top 25 of the preseason SP Plus rankings, right? They're sitting there at number 21, should have one of the better defenses in the nation. Offense is meh, but collectively, this is one of the better talent rosters in the nation. It's just a question of whether or not they can figure out quarterback.
Have you seen their schedule too?
That was going to be my argument. The reason I think that they could absolutely find their way into the top 25 is because of just how light that schedule is. Last season, that was kind of the case, found their way to, what was it, a 10-win season, 9-win season? I think that because of the fact that they kind of bring on a lot of pieces back, they could do the same thing again. They start off with Central Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana. You get South Carolina at home. You get UMass at home. You get Bama at home. That is six straight.
You do not go on the road until Jordan Hare on October 18th.
Yes, and then after that, you get Vandy, which is a beatable team, A&M at home, Mississippi State at home, Oklahoma on the road, and then Arkansas on the road to close things out. I mean, you could find yourself with 8 or 9 wins before you hit those final 2 weeks in November against the Sooners and the Razorbacks. That makes sense to me for a talented roster that won 10 games a season ago against a bad schedule to essentially kind of run it back in a sense. Eli Drinkwitz, I think, is probably at this point a pretty underrated coach considering what he's been able to do at Mizzou. Missouri is the first team that I would make an argument for. And then I kind of want to get your thoughts on this one, Christian. Second team here, and you can call me biased if you're listening out there. I don't really care. Auburn, I think, is another team that you could make a great argument for being ranked at the end of this season. And a lot of it has to do with their two big matchups at home against Georgia and Bama. I firmly believe Auburn will win one of those games this season. And if you go 8-4 winning one of those games, you're going to be ranked. If it's anything better than that, you're going to be ranked even higher. Auburn will be a top 25 team by the end of the season.
There we go. I love it. I love it. We talked about it, and we can't fire the people up on the airwaves too much, but we talked about how winnable this schedule really could be for the Auburn Tigers, but we'll save that for game day on Friday, August 29th, for when we really, really decide to fire things up for you. Well, we have just about a minute or so. Again, the music's about to kick us out here for the bottom of the hour break. We'll pick up this conversation because I know you want to talk about a couple teams that will not stay in the top 25 or will not pan out the way that the coaches poll has it right now. My team right now that stands out, it's a team I've been really high on all season or all offseason long, is Oklahoma.
Okay.
I think they are going to be a really, really good team. I think BV, Brent Venables, has a lot of pressure on him, but I think the concern has always been the offensive side of the football, again, being that defensive mindset. I think their defense is going to be solid. You now have two of the best transfer additions in John Mateer and Jade Knott. You hope that those pan out other than maybe one early week in September. Otherwise, you feel like you'd be okay with it. But that's going to be one of my teams that I think is not getting too much love right now that I think will make their way into the top 25. We continue breaking down the coaches poll in the top 25 for a moment before we flip over to the basketball side of things. And I'm just going to let Lance go absolutely crazy. But on the football side, Lance is saying Georgia doesn't make it in the top 25. We'll talk about that coming up next.
We're halfway through hour number two. You've got 30 more minutes of On the Line on ESPN 106.7, Auburn Opelika's sports leader.
We got 30 more minutes here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line. He is Lance Dahl. I'm Christian Griffin. We appreciate everybody for being here with us. And we're breaking down the coaches poll top 25, a conversation that we are continuing from yesterday. And again, we've broken down all 25 teams, where they're placed right now, how you feel like you could interchange just about any of the ones in the top 10. We just got done talking about some of the teams that we expect to make their way into the top 25 when everything is said and done. And Lance, I know you wanted to talk about a team that's, man, not even at 17, 18, or 19, a team that's in the top 5 that you possibly say or you demand will not be in the top 25 when everything is said and done. Is there a team that you're going to ease into this conversation, or are you going straight for it?
Let's just go for it.
Let's
man.
Do it.
Sometimes, you know, you can call me crazy. You can call me crazy. You can call me stupid. You can call me dumb. You can call me whatever you want. Sometimes I like to have a little fun.
More synonyms.
With the takes that I have on Locked On Kentucky and the takes I have on this show. I'm not trying to clickbait you. I just like to throw stuff out there because sometimes I feel like in the sports media world, you are confined to a certain set of opinions about college football and basketball to where if you don't have the exact same cookie cutter, oh, this is what's going to happen. These are the teams that are going to win. You are labeled as some fool, and yet you see teams like Arizona State pull it out of nowhere, despite what the analytics, despite what the pundits, despite what everybody says. Fun one for you. Probably going to end up being wrong. Don't really care. I think Georgia will
We'll cut that out. We'll cut out the probably being wrong. This is what you're going with, and this is going to be right.
This is going to be right. Georgia is either going to come close or fall out of the AP Top 25 by the end of the season. It's going to happen for two different reasons. Number one, just generally speaking, I don't think their offense is going to be as good as it was a season ago. And that was with Carson Beck and just a hodgepodge of issues. They're going to have Gunnar Stockton now. Second of all, I don't trust him. I don't trust Gunnar Stockton as QB1 for this Bulldogs team. Last season, they could not run. They were not able to run the ball at all. They were 102nd nationally in rushing yards per game. I'm not quite sure they're going to be able to replicate that this season. It's going to depend on whether or not they can get Nate Frazier to blossom into a competent running back. But that offensive line was not making any sort of headway. Not quite sure they're going to be able to do that this year. Yes, they get Zachariah Branch from USC. Not the most, like, not the craziest addition in my mind. Like, as far as, like, Georgia, the way that they like to run their scheme, I just don't know if they're going to be able to get the ball to him in effective spots or if he's going to be a 100 yards a game type guy with what is surrounding him. Quarterback, offensive line, etc. And this is not to say Georgia's bad, by the way. They're above average at just about everything, but they struggled so much at various spots a season ago against good competition or against great competition or against a freaking team like Georgia Tech at the end of the season. Just walk with me here. This is less to do with the talent roster and more to do with just a specific couple of spots that they struggled in the schedule. You go on the road to Tennessee. We talked about Tennessee earlier as a team that could possibly struggle. At the same time, that is a week 3 road trip against a team that still has a ton of high-profile talent across their team. You don't necessarily know a ton about their receiver room or their quarterback. They could hit you in the mouth and shock you early in that game. You get down by 14, 17 points, and you're asking Gunnar Stockton to throw the ball in a game that he's not comfortable in, and there you go. After that, immediately, you get Alabama at home. Bama is going to cause you a lot of problems defensively. Can you stick with them? On the road at Auburn, you get Ole Miss, who is a very good team that throttled you in the second half at Oxford a season ago. Florida in Jacksonville, that's a much improved team that should have beaten you, what was it, two seasons ago, if I'm not mistaken? It might have been actually, it was last season, but they, if I'm not mistaken, right? But DJ Lagway got hurt.
Yeah.
And so they had the Ivy League transfer in there that all the memes spawned from him, just remembering his smirk.
That was last year. Holy cow. Yeah, because Georgia's offense couldn't do anything, yeah. But One of the eventually they're going to do something, and Florida couldn't get the ball past the 50.
On top of this, oh yeah, in November you have Texas and Georgia Tech. Like a Georgia Tech team that you really should not have beaten a season ago, and a Texas team that, yes, you were able to handle, but has got more, I think, consistency on that defense just across the board. And then also, I trust Arch Manning more than I do Quinn Ewers in different spots against the Bulldogs. So, I don't know, man. There are a lot of different losable games on this schedule as opposed to seasons past, because I think Georgia is vulnerable for the first time in forever. And I've heard some reports from different people, and I don't know how valid this is. Kirby doesn't seem to be in love with this roster compared to what he's had over the past half decade or so. And frankly, I don't blame him. There's going to have to be a lot that doesn't look great on paper right now that churns around in the middle of this season to make me go, okay, the Bulldogs are going to compete for an SEC championship over a team like Alabama, over a team like LSU, South Carolina, Texas A&M, Auburn. I have my questions, and could end up being where they struggle to an 8-4, 7-5 type season, take some bad losses on the way, and they either get bumped out of the top 25 or get very close to doing so.
Don't forget, Marshall, to start the year, Georgia's only 39.5 points favored in that one. So.
Man, I'm covering.
It's one team that you haven't heard a lot about is Georgia Tech, which is funny that you mentioned them because, yeah, that game that went into how many overtimes was it?
I'm trying to pull that up
right
now. Was
it six or seven?
I think it was six, if I'm not mistaken. Of course, Georgia Tech had this just aversion to – it was eight.
Eight. That's right, because it was – yeah, the call was – yeah, like it's great to be eight or something like that, and half the people loved it, half the people did not. But Georgia Tech's not a team you're hearing a whole lot about. 7.5 is their win total projection, -130 to go over that. Their plus money to go under that. And so a team that I think could make a little bit of noise in there as well. I agree. I mean, you feel like for the first time, Kirby doesn't love every sort of position. You kind of got that at media days because he wasn't really willing to talk about depth. He wasn't really willing to talk about positions that he wanted to be a whole lot better than last year. It was much more of the coach speak of, well, if I say that, I'm going to leave a kid out or a spot out, and you know, I don't want to do anything like that. But the SEC media fan or the SEC media voting said that Texas was going to beat Georgia in the SEC championship, so they don't seem overly concerned about it. But you bring up, again, really, really good points of, man, if they didn't beat Notre Dame last year, yes, you have a little bit more of a passing attack than you did this time last year. Right. But, yeah, you just feel like there's still so many question marks. Again, with Georgia, with a bunch of these teams, again, we talked about them and how they're almost split down the middle on if you have a great quarterback or if you have a developmental piece. You feel like Kirby would be one of those teams that could get you over that hump, but Georgia was the best. Yeah, with Stetson Bennett, a quarterback, when you had everything else and the quarterback position was just that added bonus, right? Yeah. Now that you're relying on it a little bit more, you feel like there's questions and concerns that pop up.
Yeah, I want to be clear. It's not all about like whether or not, like we were talking earlier about like, hey, national title teams don't have to rely as much on their quarterback. And for this Georgia team, like, I understand that they're going to have to get something out of Gunnar Stockton, but man, I still have questions across the board on that line. Can they run the ball? Because if you can't run the ball, you're stressing your redshirt junior quarterback to do a lot of things that I don't know if he's going to be comfortable doing. Again, in some pivotal games early in the season, Tennessee, Bama, Auburn, two of those games on the road, can they get that done? Sure, the answer is they're going to absolutely have the opportunity to. Like, it's one of the best talent rosters in the nation. Kirby's one of the best coaches in the country by far. I have my questions. This could be a legitimate down year for one of the best programs in college football.
Georgia averaged 124 rushing yards per game last season, ranking them 102nd overall. And I know that put them, oh gosh, I forgot the exact number, but Kirby talked about it. They were a bottom three or four team in the SEC in rushing. Which is something that you feel like over the past decade, those two sentences or those two things in the same sentence don't make sense, right? Yeah. Georgia and not being able to run the football. But yeah, if you're not able to, if you only get 120 rushing yards per game, that's going to rely on Gunnar Stockton to get you 240, 250, through the air. And that's where, yeah, you have a lot of faith, you hope, but then a lot of question marks on if every other drive you're 3rd and 8, 3rd and 9.
And look, I understand with Stockton, like, he's going to have the offseason to develop. He's going to have the offseason to be QB1 in the system. Just mechanically, just what we've seen, it's just awkward. It's just it's a bullet or it's nothing else, what we saw from Stockton. Not great decision making. And this is not the identity that Georgia wants. They didn't want to be 12th nationally in passing yards per game a season ago. They didn't want to be chucking the ball around. They want to be smash mouth physical football and establish that ground game. If they try and get back to that and they fail, it's all coming back to do the pieces around that outside of that defense make this thing work. The defense, I don't have a ton of concerns about. Not necessarily this year, but man, that offense, I just, like, let me ask you this. Last year, they averaged 32.6 points per game. If they dropped to 29-ish points per contest, how many of these teams are they beating? Are they beating Bama? Are they beating Tennessee? Are they beating Auburn? Are they beating Florida? Like, are you beating a team if you take a dip offensively like that without just confidence to consistently drive in and drive out, put something on the board? I don't know.
Especially you mentioned, yeah, Tennessee being week 3 on the road. Fortunately, again, we talked with Jordan Hill of Dogs 24/7, our Georgia inside analyst expert, and he talked about how the schedule is a little bit more favorable for Georgia this year rather than last year, just because you do get some of these games at home.
Right.
Yet you feel like a lot of these teams have made that big step up, or at least are expecting to make that step up. And so how much will a home environment play if Georgia has not taken that step up? I still think Sanford Stadium at night is going to be a very, very exciting place to play, or to watch. It is not a very exciting place to play when Alabama goes there on September 27th. But I'm with you. I think that could be one of the teams. My team, we mentioned them a little bit. I think Michigan. Yeah. I think Michigan is my team that I think could make its way out of the top 25. They're going to beat New Mexico. I think they fall to Oklahoma in week 2 on the road in Norman. That puts you at 2-1. Central Michigan, you go to 2-1. I think you lose to Nebraska. You go to 2-2. I think you beat Wisconsin to go to 3-2. You lose to USC, Southern Cal, to go to 3-3. You lose to Washington, I think, in my opinion. You go to 3-4. You beat Michigan State, Purdue, and Northwestern. You beat Maryland, and you lose to Ohio State. That's 4, if not 5, losses for this Michigan team. I know that Bryce Underwood is supposed to be fantastic. Is there confirmed that he is going to be the starter? I don't know if that's been completely released. You feel like that's going to be the way that they go about it, but man, a freshman making his first true road start in Norman, and then you have to sit there and go through the gauntlet of a schedule like this. I understand that some of these games are relatively easy, but I don't know if I see them getting over the hump in some of these big-time games.
Most recent reports on the quarterback battle coming from 24/7 Sports Michigan site says Michigan will keep its starting quarterback competition open until mid-August for several reasons, but most indicators are that Underwood will be the Wolverines' first true freshman week 1 starter in 15 years. Mikey Keene is the guy that will try and push back on that after missing spring practices due to injury. If it's Keene, that's going to be pushing him. My guess is that Underwood's talent's probably going to win out. Also, holy cow, I just saw who their offensive coordinator is. Do you want to please take a just guess who Michigan's OC is?
I couldn't tell you.
Chip Lindsey.
Is he really?
Is their offensive coordinator for
this
season.
Why did I feel like that did not make any sort of news?
I am shocked that I didn't see anything about that. Michigan offensive coordinator Chip Lindsey. How on earth did that just slip by? Wow.
He was hired on December 13th of 2024.
Wow, so he's been there for a minute. Yeah, they're cooked.
Holy cow.
You're right. Yeah. I don't need to hear anything
else. There we go. Yeah, Michigan, you, sorry, buddy, you're out.
It's over.
On our way out, again, football's dominated this segment. We are expecting it to be a little bit of basketball talk, but I know that you are a big basketball guy, and I'm sure that you have obviously heard the news and celebrated with the rest of America that the college basketball March Madness tournament will not be expanding. It will stay at 68 teams at least for the 2026 season. You imagine that's just because some sort of agreement was not made, but we'll take whatever wins we can get. Your thoughts when you first read that news?
There are 364 teams that compete in Division I college basketball every season. 68 teams is enough to try and decide a national champion. For me personally, I am in the camp of, yo, the NCAA tournament's not a good decider of who is the best team in the sport. I think that's kind of a no-duh, but also at the same time, you get a lot of people arguing, well, it's still fun. And it absolutely is. It is a great product, which is why they're going to eventually expand it. It is an entertaining product. For me, I think that expansion is a bad idea because you don't need 72 teams to decide a champion. You just don't need that. It's the same thing for college football. You don't need a 16-team playoff. You don't need a 24-team playoff. There's just simply not enough good teams in college football to warrant having a playoff that big outside of the fact that you want to make more money off of the TV markets that are trying to push this, or off of the TV executives that are trying to push this to get extra money. For college basketball, there's a little bit more parity, but I would also point you towards a really good video that SB Nation did a few years ago. It was by John Boyes, who was just incredible, breaking down how the NCAA tournament's a losing machine. Consistently, it doesn't matter if you get your Cinderella that makes the Elite Eight, the Sweet 16, the Final Four, what have you. They're not going to win. It's usually a few teams that win, and just throwing in these extra four or six teams doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything for the sport. I feel like it's a waste of time.
Following that up, again, we talked about it yesterday. There's been four number eight seeds that have made it to the national championship. Only four.
Four? Okay.
Only four. That's the highest, or that's the lowest. So you're sitting there, but if we go to 78 teams, there's going to be an 18 team or an 18 seed that has a chance, right?
Right. No. Well, the argument against that is like, well, like at least you want to be able to give them the opportunity, like these lower seeds to like at least make their run, and then for them to benefit financially and to get the exposure or what have you. For me, just personally, if I would want something that determines the best team in the country, and I don't feel like the NCAA tournament's the most effective way of doing that. Expanding the field does not help that. That's just my thought.
Don't water down the product.
Yes, don't water down the product just to make some more money. And yet, I like you've got written down in our show notes here, is expansion inevitable? I think it is, which sucks for us, for fans of both sports, that we're not going to get a chance to see, you know, the best teams go at it year in and year out. It's not fun.
What do we know?
Well, let me reiterate. It is fun to an extent, but if the goal is to crown a champion accurately, this is not the way to do it.
John Rothstein, somebody that we quote quite frequently as we get to break here to wrap up the show, says, this was yesterday, says, "Dear America, today is a great day for college basketball. This is what victory feels like. Our way of life has earned the right to go on. Anarchy? Nope. Just common sense. Sincerely, John Rothstein." Why can't guys like that have a little bit more say, right? Somebody that lives, eats, and breathes every single part of college basketball, every single dribble. Anarchy? Nope. Just common sense. I absolutely love it. We'll take our final break here on the Tuesday edition of On the Line, come back and wrap everything up.
You are on the line with Jacob Goins and Christian Griffin, online at ESPNAU.com and on the Radio Alabama app.
Man, part two of the graphic, just lying to the people. Jacob Goins, man. He skipped out. Skipped out on Monday and Tuesday. No, just playing. He's back with us tomorrow. Just a little couple of vacation days before we get going with high school football, man. That is 17 days away. That is exciting and intimidating from the standpoint of, A, making sure we have everything done, making sure that we're prepared, and then just being on air on Friday nights. Not the on-air part, but making sure we sound halfway decent with our calls, man. It's going to be an absolute blast. Jacob with Auburn High School over on Wings, myself with Lee Scott Academy on AU 100.3 FM. Lance, appreciate you for being here with us once again. Appreciate Jack Hudden for being here with us yesterday. Lindsey Crosby for joining us on the show once again today. If you missed any of the show, you can check it out on the Podcast Center over on ESPNAU.com. We talked about, man, a whole lot. We covered fall practice. We covered the offensive line. We covered the coaches poll, the top 25. We had a baseball power half hour that, Lance, I know that you loved a whole lot. I know that there's a whole lot of love right now with the Braves because they just can't seem to do anything right. But, no, appreciate you once again for coming on.
All my homies know is pain, first and foremost. Second of all, we are so close, man. We're so close. College football, high school football, it's almost back. It's the best time of the year, Christian. I'm fired up. I'm ready for it.
We had the Hall of Fame game on Tuesday last week, I believe.
Yes, sir.
And KLS. They said that that was the last week of no football until February.
Give it to me, baby.
Holy cow. Think about that. And yes, Keandre Lambert-Smith absolutely balled out. Man, we're ready for football season. If you can't tell, the entire show covered up here for it. I'm sure we're going to have a whole lot more talking about it tomorrow. Jacob Goins back in the studio with us tomorrow. But for today, for Lance Dahl, I'm Christian Griffin. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you later.